So I think I'm going to go ahead and get started. My name's Adam Boland. I'm a PhD student at MIT. And today I'm going to be talking about simulating adiabatic quantum computing. And now this is a focus lecture, so it's really intended for people whose specialty is not quantum information. So feel free to interrupt me or ask any questions you have during the course of the lecture. So one remarkable fact that one thing I should say is that we've changed rooms from on the website, so that's okay. If you're looking for a bulk reconstruction, you should go upstairs, and if you're looking for a quantum information lecture on adiabatic quantum computing, then you're in the right place. All right, cool. So as Stephen Jordan mentioned in some of his earlier lectures, kind of one remarkable fact about quantum computing is that all of the different models of quantum computing that we could come up with turn out to be equivalent to one another in their computational power. Like, for instance, quantum circuits have the same power of quantum Turing machines. Those have the same power as topological quantum computing with anions and quantum finite automata. And this is kind of a remarkable fact because a priori, it didn't have to be this way. It could have been that thinking about quantum computing from different perspectives could have led to kind of different amounts of computational power in different models.
Are they all proven, or are some of these conjectures?
Yeah, these are all proven. Yeah, so this is just they're just all give the complexity class BQP. So yep.
Quantum finite automata generalization of discrete finite.
Yes. Yeah. In the quantum setting, so you're allowed to perform like unitaries.
But in the classical, it's not equivalent to the
Oh, yeah. Okay, so maybe. Okay, so maybe I'll just erase this one here. Okay, so but topological quantum computing is equivalent, and though actually, if maybe someone should correct me, but anyways, topological quantum computing is equivalent to these other ones too, though, as are quantum Turing machines. So these are all the same model of computation. But now today, as you can tell, I'm not going to be talking about quantum finite automata. I'm going to be talking about the proof that quantum computing with quantum circuits and with adiabatic quantum computing is equivalent. And this is because this construction uses some really nice techniques known as a Feynman-Kitaev clock construction, which if you've never seen it before, it's definitely worth checking out. So that's kind of the purpose of today's lecture, is to introduce you to this idea. So let me just write that down. So first, let's just take, 1 minute to recall what these different computational models are. So circuit quantum computing is defined by the following computational model. We imagine that we start with some really simple state, like say n copies of the zero state. Okay? And then we apply a sequence of 2-qubit unitary gates. So let's say we first apply some 2-qubit unitary gate U1. Then the state of our system evolves to some state psi1. This is just, U1 tensor the identity applied to 0 to the n. Then we apply another 2-qubit unitary U2 to the same substate psi2, which is, U2 times psi1. And then we keep going. And then at the end, we obtain substate psi sub capital T, where capital T, which is the number of gates that we apply, this is some polynomial in the number of qubits. Okay, so in some sense, you can think of the circuit model as kind of capturing the power of engineered quantum devices which have time-dependent Hamiltonians. In other words, you imagine that you have some quantum device that you have. And so you can change the potentials or the fields or something in your quantum device to induce a change in the Hamiltonian that you're applying. And you can do that differently for different times. So at this point, you induce a Hamiltonian, which is the log of U1. At this point, you induce a Hamiltonian, which is the log of U2, et cetera. And you do this polynomially many times. Now, the adiabatic quantum computing model looks entirely different. And this model is, you can kind of think of it as it's trying to capture the power of ground states of Hamiltonians, which are kind of like, you know, time independent Hamiltonians. Like if you let, you know, a system cool for an infinite amount of time to its ground state, you know, what would the state of the system be? So in this model, there's kind of a different step. So we imagine that we have some Hamiltonian, some initial Hamiltonian, H init, and it has some ground state, psi naught. And we imagine that this ground state is something which is very easy to prepare on a quantum computer. So for example, like you could have H init be the sum over sites of sigma x applied to that site, in which case psi naught is just, you know, the following state, 0 plus 1 over root 2, n copies of that. All right, and then our goal in adiabatic quantum computing isn't to get this ground state of H init, it's to get the ground state of a different Hamiltonian, and that Hamiltonian we'll call H final. And this has some ground state, let's call it psi final. And the goal of the computation is to prepare the state psi final. And the idea is to set up your Hamiltonian H such that its ground state psi final encodes the answer to some computational problem of interest. So that's kind of so let me just write this. So this is psi final's what encodes the answer to your problem. All right, and you know, maybe a natural question that you might ask is, how do you actually prepare a Hamiltonian such that its ground state has the answer to some problem of interest? So it turns out that there are really simple and natural constructions that you can use to do this. So can you guys still see it up here? Yeah, okay, cool. So,
okay.
Yeah, seems that this thing, is there something I can like set on this?
More erasers.
Yeah. Get some more erasers. Yeah. Counterweight. It's like an engineering test for giving a lecture. Okay. Well, I'll just try to hold it down as best I can. Okay. So, all right. So I'll give you an example of a way that you can encode a hard problem as the ground state of a Hamiltonian. So the basic idea is this. So let's consider a computer science problem. It's called three satisfiability. So how many of you have seen three satisfiability before? Okay, so most people, but not everyone. So the setup of the problem is something like this. Like you imagine that you have a collection of n Boolean variables. So each variable is either in state 0 or 1, or you know, true or false. And you imagine that you have a collection of clauses. All right, over these variables. And each clause will consist of a disjunction of three literals over these variables. So what does that mean? It's something very simple. So for instance, one clause could be, you know, I either want x1 to be true, or I want x2 to be true, or I want x3 to be false. All right, so let's say this is clause 1. Or another clause could be, you know, I want x2 to be true, or x4 to be false, or x5 to be true, all right, and et cetera. So you come up with a list of m clauses, where m is a polynomial in n. All right, and the question of three set is, does there exist an assignment to the variables which satisfies all of your clauses? All right, so this is a canonical problem in theoretical computer science. It's actually a very difficult problem. This is known to be an NP-hard problem, which is to say that if you could solve this problem, you could solve essentially any problem efficiently for which you can verify the answer efficiently. So this is like one of these, you know, I think Stephen Jordan referred to it as like a magical guessing class. Like if you imagine you can magically guess the answer, then you could check it. But, you know, coming up with the answer could be very difficult because how many different assignments are there to these n variables? Well, they're two to the n, right? So there's too many choices for you to just try each one. Yep.
Why is it called three-set?
Yeah, it's called three-set because, so it's three because each clause involves at most three variables. Yeah. Good. All right. Awesome. So, all right. So now I'm going to show that it's actually very easy to encode, to write a Hamiltonian whose ground state encodes that problem, the answer to three-set. All right. And the thing, the construction is really simple. So let's say you have some clause, which is like this, x1 or x2 or x3 bar. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a system of n qubits. I'm going to make one of them for each variable. All right. And then what I'm going to do is for each clause, I'm going to add a term like this in the Hamiltonian. So what's this clause saying? So it's saying either x1 has to be true, or x2 has to be true, or x3 has to be false, right? So another way of saying that is saying that you can't, like any assignment to this is acceptable, except the one that sets this to false, and this to true. Because that's actually the only assignment that does not satisfy this clause. Like, so in other words, so now, since there's only one forbidden assignment, All right, so the forbidden assignment is the state 001. X1 is 1. Sorry. X1 equals 0, X2 equals 0, X3 equals 1. So now what we'll do is we'll add a term to our Hamiltonian, H1. And that term will just make it a projector onto the following state. 0 on qubit 1, 0 on qubit 2, 1 on qubit 3, and the same thing on the other side. All right, and likewise, you know, if you have the clause that had, you know, if you had a different clause like x2 bar, x3, or x4, you'd write the same thing. You just write a projector onto the forbidden assignment for those variables. And now each of these involves only three qubits, you know, and this is in tensor product with the identity on the remaining qubits. Okay, so whenever I don't write something like that, you know, I implicitly mean there's a tensor product with the identity symbol. Okay, cool. So now note that if you have a state psi, which so now what you'll do is you write your Hamiltonian be the sum over all these clauses of these HIs. And now I claim that if you have a so this is a sum of projectors, so this is a PSD matrix. So I claim that if you're, if there's any state psi, say it's some superposition over states, such that H annihilates psi, which is to say that H is, that psi is a ground state on it, then I claim that for any x in the support of psi, it has to be a valid assignment that satisfies all the clauses. Right? You can see this immediately because you know what this Hamiltonian is doing is it's just applying an energy penalty every time you violate a clause. So if you have energy zero, it means you violate nothing. Right? So in other words, so the ground space of this Hamiltonian, this is just equal to the span over x, which are satisfying assignments of ket x. So this is a very natural way to encode a difficult problem is the ground state of a Hamiltonian. All right, any questions about this so far? Okay. So one thing that's nice about this is that this Hamiltonian that we wrote down is actually very explicit. So this is one condition that you actually need to put on your Hamiltonians in the adiabatic model or kind of any model of computation you deal with, is that you have this condition, which is that H is efficiently describable. Now, there are two different ways of defining this. One way which we'll use here is that H is a sum of local terms. In other words, each term only acts on a finite number of qubits, say, you know, 3 or something like that. Another way of describing what it means for a Hamiltonian to be, you know, efficiently describable is, which is more generic, is that H is kind of sparse and is sparse. So what I mean by that, so imagine that if you write out H, you know, it's a Hamiltonian on n qubits. So it means it's a giant 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. So one way of describing, of making a Hamiltonian efficiently scribable is that to say each row of H has at most polynomially many entries, number of non-zero entries. And there exists a polytime algorithm which, given a row, outputs the non-zeros. So you can easily see that this is a generalization of the concept of a Hamiltonian being a sum of local terms in tensor product with the identity. Because if you want to find, you know, the entries in any one row, you just look at the clauses. You just look at the Hamiltonians that have some support over, you know, over those states, and and just write them out. But it turns out that everything we see today will actually generalize to these sorts of Hamiltonians and not just sums of local terms. Yep.
So this sparsity definition is for a certain basis.
Yes, that's right. So let's say in the computational basis. That's right. This is a basis dependent measure. And you could say it's also, if it's sparse in like the Fourier basis, that would work too, because, you know, we can change basis between the Fourier basis and the computational basis efficiently.
So does this three-shot program satisfy all these conditions?
Yeah, it does. It does, and it actually satisfies this one. So this is like a more restrictive version of efficiently scribal. So it meets the strictest one. Oh yeah, that's a good question. So I'm going to get to that right now.
Because I'm told that it's not whether.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Exactly. So the short answer to that is no, but that's. Yeah, so I can explain why the answer to that is no briefly now. I'll get to it in 1 second. So we've seen how to encode super hard problems as the ground states of our Hamiltonian. So how are we going to try to prepare this ground state? Well, the idea is to try and use adiabatic evolution. So we have defined some Hamiltonian, family of Hamiltonians, H of S, which is, you know, as S varies from 0 to 1, it starts out in your initial Hamiltonian, and then slowly evolves to slowly turn on the final Hamiltonian. And the hope is that if you evolve this slowly enough, then you'll remain in the ground state of the system the entire time. And then that means that you'll be able to prepare the state psi final at the end of your evolution. So now, when can we hope for this sort of approach to work? Well, you know, to understand how the approach works, what we really need to do is understand the eigenvalue structure of H of S as we vary S. So I'm going to draw this pictorially. So I'll draw one line representing the value of the lowest energy state of the Hamiltonian H of S. So this is S going from 0 to 1. And I'll draw another line for lambda 1, which is the energy of the first excited state of the Hamiltonian. So now, if you're, all right, so maybe this is a question. So now, imagine that your Hamiltonian energy landscape looks like this. So now, do you think that adiabatic evolution will end you up in the ground state? So I think the answer should be no. And the reason is that we have this weird property that at one point, the energies of the first and second excited states coincide. So this is what's called a level crossing. All right, and what that means is that once your state even if you stay in the ground state up to this point, once your state gets here, there should be a really high chance of it jumping to a higher excited state. And, you know, at least like 50% chance or something like that here. And there's a pretty good chance that your computation gets derailed. Yep.
Can this be expressed in saying that at that point, you know, like Schrodinger's equation having degenerate solutions or something like this? What you should really be doing is saying, okay, right before S, my state is the ground state of the bottom part.
Yeah.
And then I'm solving at every point.
That's true.
Similarity or something?
I see what you mean. Tomas pointing out, the question that Tomas pointing out was that, you know, maybe it's not a good idea of thinking about what happens exactly at this point, because that's when you hit a degenerate ground state, and then maybe your second eigenvalue is actually something up here, because what you really just did is you hit a degeneracy, right? So this is actually a hole or something like that. So maybe you should be thinking about things at getting asymptotically closer to that point and the gap getting infinitesimally small.
I'm asking if you can actually solve this, if you can solve Schrodinger's equation for such a system and see that.
That has a level crossing and compute the probability of transition?
Compute the state evolution.
That's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head. So, yeah. Maybe someone.
Langevin's problem, standard result.
And
you can calculate the transition probability.
You can.
And it's some.
What do you see? So, does it go up or down, or does it split?
It's probabilistic. Some probability will go up and some probability will go down.
So, is it like 50-50 probability of going up or down, or is it some other constant probability of transition?
It depends on the parameters.
It depends on. Okay, yeah.
So, there's no singularity. You can just compute it.
There's no singularity.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. All right. So, if there's, you know, if the Hamiltonians have a level crossing, then there's some substantial probability you get derailed and this whole process fails. On the other hand, if there's never a level crossing and there's always a big gap between your energies and your excited states, let's call this gap delta. So delta is just the min over S of the value of the energy of the first excited state minus the ground state. So on the other hand, if delta is really big, then you expect that, you know, it seems reasonable that you should be able to stay in the ground state, right? And this is because, you know, you're kind of protected by a large energy gap. And if there's a large energy gap, then it should be hard to tunnel through this energy barrier to reach the first excited state. Yep.
So you encode your Hamiltonian such that answers in the first and the ground states?
Oh, yeah. That's a great question. But normally normally when you're talking about exactly computing NP hard problems, you're usually talking about finding the exact ground state. Now, if you're trying to just approximate the solution, then maybe you might be interested in the first few excited states. But actually, there's this result in theoretical computer science called the PCP theorem, which says that actually even getting a constant factor approximation to the lowest, you know, possible energy of this, of a Hamiltonian like this, is actually still NP hard. So even that for most of these NP hard Hamiltonians is not really going to help you. All right, cool. So, in short, the power of this model is a function of this gap. And as Stephen said before, there's this result which is called the adiabatic theorem, which says that if you vary S from 0 to 1 over time around 1 over delta squared, then you stay in the ground state with high probability. All right. So this means that if you want to understand the power of this model, what you really have to do is understand, you know, how big your gap is as you vary this Hamiltonian. So if you're able to show that when trying to solve an NP-hard problem or something, that you can keep a big gap, like an inverse polynomial gap throughout this whole evolution, then you will have shown how to prepare the ground state and solve this hard problem. All right, so this is why. To give you guys a little bit of a history of this model. So this model was first proposed by Farhi, Goldstone, Gutman, and Sipser in 2000. And when they proposed the law, I think they had some hope that they would be able to use this to solve NP-hard problems, because they saw that there is just this really simple way of encoding solutions to hard problems as ground states, and they thought, you know, great, like maybe we can use this to prove that quantum computers, you know, can solve NP-hard problems with this sort of adiabatic approach. So in short, it seemed possibly more powerful was kind of the line of thinking that was going into this. On the other hand, you know, there are some other things which were like, you know, maybe this model could actually be less powerful. Like, how do you factor on this? Like, although we showed that you can solve an NP-hard problem on this model, you know, we didn't show how to, you know, like run Grover's algorithm or run something else. You know, maybe like there's some algorithms that work really well in circuits, and there's some algorithms that work really well in the adiabatic theorem. And these two models are incomparable. So this was kind of a little up in the air when they proposed this model, until two different results showed that this was equivalent. So the first result was this, a proof by Van Dam, Mosca, and Vazirani in 2002, which showed that, you know, adiabatic quantum computing is not more powerful than you know, circuits. So in other words, like, if you can do something with adiabatic, then you can also solve that with circuits too. So you aren't buying yourself any additional power. All right, and this was actually even noted in Farhi, Goldstone, Gutman, and Sipser's original paper to some extent as well. So in other words, so that then splashed some water on this idea of this being a more powerful model. But now the more interesting direction, I'll just say one second about the proof of this fact, which is, you know, the proof of this fact is basically using the algorithm that Stephen Jordan summarized in his lectures, where, you know, you just apply the Hamiltonian using trotterization. So if you have some Hamiltonian, which is a sum of local terms, you know, all you do to approximate time evolution by that is just alternate between applying one and the other very quickly. And then, and you can, in polynomial time, induce inverse polynomial error in simulating your evolution. So, yep.
So are you applying e to the minus HT, or?
Yeah, e to the minus IHT. Yeah, like.
With an I or no I?
With an I. So H is Hermitian, so e to the IHT is your unitary, yeah.
But I mean, you could have thermalization is some CPTP map, and you could always Steinsberg-dilate that on a non-computer. Simulate that.
Yeah. So you could try to just use thermalization to solve your problem as well, but this is kind of like a classical computing technique. This is kind of saying like, oh, you try random assignments and then keep, you know, going further and further towards the basin of your potential function. So this is more like a randomized algorithm for the problem and not really a quantum algorithm. And those algorithms tend to get stuck in local minima is basically what happens with this. Okay. All right. So, any more questions about the proof that it's less powerful? All right. So now the more complicated direction, which is what I'll be covering in detail today, is the second result that came out 2 days later, and this was by Aharonov, Van Dan, Kemp, Landau, Lloyd, and Regev in 2004. Okay, the preprint was in 2004. The paper is in 2007. And they showed that circuits can be simulated by adiabatic evolution too. All right, and this is maybe the less obvious direction. And the reason that this is less obvious is because of this issue of time. So the one thing that's really confusing with these Hamiltonians is that, you know, they're kind of the power of these time. Let's say you have some circuit that you're trying to simulate by an adiabatic evolution. The thing is that you perform that circuit by applying some time-independent Hamiltonian. So what's really not obvious is how do you specify a Hamiltonian. Such that its ground state is slice of t, which is the state that you get after applying all of your gates in your Quantum circuit. It's really not obvious how to do this because, you know, this, if you take this Hamiltonian, all right, so, you know, in total, you've performed some unitary U to the circuit. And that unitary U, you know, you can think of that as inducing some Hamiltonian, you know, it's e to the ih for some Hamiltonian h, you just take its log. But that Hamiltonian h might be really complicated to describe. Like, you know, it might not have the sparsity condition because you've exponentiated it. And furthermore, it's, you know, your state isn't even the ground state of that. It's just you just evolved with that Hamiltonian for some finite time. Like, that's all that occurred. So it's really unclear how to specify a Hamiltonian which has this as the ground state to your system. And actually, this problem is still open. So the way that these authors solve this problem is by, you know, time-honored technique of, you know, if you can't solve a problem, just solve a different one. So what they did, all right, so maybe the answer is this, is like maybe you can't. But what you can do is you can create a Hamiltonian whose ground state it looks different. All right, and what we'll do is we'll create a Hamiltonian whose ground state is the following. So I'm going to sum over time steps t of the state at time t in tensor product with a representation of the time. So this state, it's called the history state. I'll write psi hist for the history state. And what it is it encodes the entire history of the quantum computation that took you from the initial state 0 to the n and took you all the way to psi sub t. And this state, you know, in some sense, it captures the entire history. So, you know, it has two registers. One register we'll call the state register. So I'll give it a superscript s. And the other state we call the clock register. And this is a register that encodes, you know, what time in the computation you're at. And now the remarkable thing is that although you can't necessarily create a Hamiltonian that has a ground state of this state, you can create a Hamiltonian whose ground state is this state. And now it turns out that if you can prepare this state, you know, you can easily see this suffices to simulate the circuit with polynomial overhead. So does anyone see why that's true? Yep.
So, like, let's say I was trying to simulate a quantum system, and that was the quantum computation I was trying to do, and I want to see how I could do it. The circuit, or adiabatic. In the circuit model, I could just time evolve with respect to the Hamiltonian and see how it evolves. And I feel like the adiabatic case is kind of like if your Hamiltonian for that was like your Lagrangian in some sense, and the eigenvalues were like the action of each configuration, it finds kind of the path of least action through the getting to the ground state. Is that, and then this is like, you know, like the configuration through time, and then you some intuition there.
That's kind of intuition. I mean, what this, to prepare the state history state, we will follow some like adiabatic path from some really simple state. Actually, so like the initial state that you start with is something like this. So actually, the initial state that will start our adiabatic computation is just this, psi sub 0, 0. In other words, we just start the initial state as just being at time 0. So in other words, so this is, you know, this state is just 0 to the n. Right? So what we will do is we'll create a Hamiltonian. This is the intuition that. What we'll do is we'll create a Hamiltonian that starts in the state psi initial and then has some probability or, you know, some amplitude of applying the gates in sequence to this. And the hope is that, you know, by adiabatically adiabatically evolving from this Hamiltonian, this one will kind of stay in the ground state and kind of simulate our entire time evolution. So that's the high level picture. But in order to explain how that works, I think I should just write out what the Hamiltonian is that actually has this as the ground state, because this is where all the magic is happening in this construction. Okay. All right, cool. So now, to create a Hamiltonian that has that history state as the ground state, it's going to come in three parts. So the first part is going to be very simple. So first, we're going to have a part that ensures that the clock register increments with time in the way that we want it to. All right, the second part is we'll have some part that assures that our state begins in the all zero state at the start of our computation. And then finally, we'll have some Hamiltonians that check for time evolution, which I'll specify next. All right, so now how are we going to check for all of these things? So in order to explain this, I'm first going to have to explain how this clock register stores time. And this is kind of a weird construction, but we're actually going to use a very wasteful representation of this clock. So let's say that you had t time steps. You know, probably the simplest way to store the time would just be using like a binary counter. So that would only need log base 2 of t qubits in order to encode that many different times, right? But we're actually going to use a different type of clock, and we're going to use a unary clock. So what that is that the time t, it's going to be represented by the following state: a sequence of t1s followed by a sequence of capital T minus T zeros. So this is, you know, in other words, you just write the timeout in unary. And, you know, in some sense, this is kind of a worthless clock. Like, you never go to Walmart and buy a unary clock for your desk, because it's just, like, not an efficient way to store or look at or understand time. But it turns out that this, writing it in this very inefficient representation is actually going to be helpful for allowing us to make this Hamiltonian local. All right. So now maybe I'll explain what these different parts of this Hamiltonian are. So the first part is this. So the point of each clock is to ensure that the clock is functioning correctly. In other words, you want to ensure that your clock state is always of the form 1 to the t, 0 to the capital T minus t. All right, and I claim that a way to do that is to set this Hamiltonian equal to the following thing. You simply forbid any two adjacent states being in the state 0, 1. So this is sum over I. These are acting on the clock registers. And these are from qubit I of the clock to qubit I plus 1 of the clock. So all this is saying is that if you ever see a 0, 1 in your string, apply a penalty, right? An energy penalty of 1. So now this, if you're in the ground state of H clock, then that means that your clock register is of this form. Okay, does that make sense? So far, so good? All right, so this is the simple part of the construction. All right, now the next thing is this initial thing. This is to ensure that your psi 0 is of the form 0 to the n. So what we do, we just set equal to something like this. We say, you know, if the clock is in state 0, so I'm going to say this is on qubit I of the clock. So if the ith bit of the qubit of the clock is 0, then make sure that your ith qubit of your initial state is not in the form 1. Okay, so let me just.
I have a question about.
Yeah, sure.
Isn't it the case that the t equals 0 and t equals capital T has lower energy than the others?
At capital 0 and capital T?
Small t is 0 or capital T, because all 0 or all 1s. And these have different.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So there are actually. So yeah. So the question was, aren't there different things that you have to do for little t equals 0 and little t equals 1?
Right.
Yes, there are. Yeah. But there's just some. I'm not going to go through the edge cases, but there's just like a little trick you
so
need to do.
The edge.
Yeah, I'm ignoring the edge. I'm just saying in the middle. Yeah. Okay. Good question. I'm just going to write the edge things for the middle stuff for simplicity.
Okay.
All right. So all this is trying to do is just force your qubits to such that when the clock's all zeros, you better be in the state zero. All right. So now...
Excuse me?
Yeah, sure.
This suggests that there are as many clock registers as qubits.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right, that's right. So I think the only important thing is that you have complete coverage of the clock. So, yeah, so if there's duplicates, like, you know, if one of the registers is bigger than the other, then all you have to do is make sure that there's at least one term that hits every one of these qubits. So then, yeah, so then it, yeah, that's basically all you need. So it's, yeah, that's not a problem. But yeah, that's a good question. Okay. So now the magic of this construction all comes in this last term. And this last term, I'm going to explain to you as, you know, having some intuition. The intuition to have is that this Hamiltonian, this term, the Hamiltonian, kind of implements a random walk over states. So what's this? So I'll first write it out, and then I think you'll then see what's going on. So what this Hamiltonian is going to do is going to check that you go from t to t plus 1 correctly. All right. So what is it? You first do the identity on the state tensored with t. Now this isn't manifestly local, but I'll make it local in a second. All right. And then you then subtract the unitary u sub t on the state which takes t to t plus 1. Then you subtract ut dagger from the state that takes t plus 1 to t, runs backwards in time. And then you add the identity tensor t plus 1, t plus 1. All right. So what does this look like from the t perspective? You know, if you write this out, this Hamiltonian is this. It's I minus u dagger. All right, so this is Hermitian. Okay, so what is going on with this Hamiltonian? So I'm going to claim that when you time evolve with this Hamiltonian, it's kind of like making a random walk on your state. So let's imagine, so let's say that... we initialize our state in this state. So we start out at time zero. Then if you apply this Hamiltonian to that state, what does it do? Well, it has some probability of moving your time evolution forward by u sub t. And it has some other probability. Okay, these are amplitudes, not probabilities, but just, you know, follow this analogy for a second. It has some other probability of running time backwards and applying u sub t dagger. So what you can think of is you can think of this as like kind of applying a, you know, it's kind of like a Markov chain that mixes your states. So if you imagine that you write, you know, your different times of your computation on the line. So right, this is t equals 0 up to t equals capital T. What this Hamiltonian does is it has, you know, some probability of keeping you in the same state. You know, some amplitude on running you backwards, forwards in time, and some amplitude on running you backwards in time. And then the intuition that as to why this works to allow you to prepare this history state is that, you know, if you apply this kind of operation, then this very quickly mixes your initial state over the entire line. And this is essentially the proof that this history state works. So now, a few things. So first of all, you know, let's just do the calculation to show that the history state's a ground state of this, because this is instructive. So let's imagine that we take this h sub t and we apply it to the history state. Okay, well, what happens? So note that h sub t only ever, you know, has any overlap with the clock states, which are in states t or t plus 1, right? So everything gets annihilated except these terms, right? U, t, psi t, t plus 1, plus psi t, t. All right, great. So now let's look at what happens when we apply the Hamiltonian to each of these terms. So, all right, so see, there's some probability we just keep this term here, so some amplitude. So this gives us psi t t. Now this term applied to this term subtracts off a ut times psi t t plus 1, because this increments the counter and applies u. And now this term, well, it only has overlap with this, so it applies ut dagger to this state, which is ut psi t, and then runs the time backwards. And then it has also some amplitude of applying, of just keeping this the same, right? Which is ut psi t t plus 1. All right? And now note that this is 0, because this term cancels with this one, and this term cancels with this one. So that's the proof that this is a ground state of this Hamiltonian, because, you know, it's just a sum of projectors. So it's a PSD matrix, so therefore it's, you know, if you find the 0 eigenstate, then that means you found the ground state as well.
Does this Hamiltonian have a unique ground state?
Yes, this actually does have a unique ground state. Yeah. Okay, cool. So now, all right, great. So we're, you know, we're halfway there. We've shown that, you know, we can create some Hamiltonian whose ground state encodes this history state. And we've also shown that, you know, we can create some, maybe I haven't specified, but, you know, there's some initial Hamiltonian you can create where all it is you take this H final, and instead of tracing, so instead of, you keep these terms, which just ensure that the clock works, and then instead of having this term that ensures, you know, transitions between times, you just have another term which just sets the clock to 0. Just says the clock state has to be in the all 0 state. So that's just like the term, you know, 1, 1 on each of the clock qubits. All right. So what you, so yeah, the ground state of that is this initial state, and then you slowly apply, you know, this Hamiltonian and you get the history state. All right, so we're halfway there to proving that this is an adiabatic algorithm to simulate the circuit, but there's one ingredient missing, and the ingredient missing is the gap, right? Because the whole thing that controls the complexity of adiabatic evolution is how large the gap is. So in order to prove that, this model actually produces H final, we have to say something about the gap of these intermediate Hamiltonians. All right, so what does the gap of this Hamiltonian look like? Which I think I'm just going to use maybe this blackboard so that it's next to the other one. Okay. All right, so how do you prove that the gap is inverse polynomial? All right, so there are a few different steps to this proof. So one step is this. So let V be the span of valid clock states. In other words, it's all clock states which are of this form, as you know, they're written out in unary appropriately. All right. So now note that our initial state lies in this subspace. And also, our Hamiltonian HF also preserves the subspace as well. So it means that as we time evolve, we'll actually always remain in the subspace for the entirety of the computation. So, all right, since H preserves V throughout the computation, This means that, you know, it suffices to prove a gap. For the subspace V only, like where you take the Hamiltonian and you restrict it to the subspace. All right, so now how do you prove this gap? So the way that you prove this gap is actually just by making formal this intuition that I told you before. So it turns out that there's a theorem which says that, you know, under certain conditions, the spectral gap of your Hamiltonian is actually polynomially related to the spectral gap of a particular Markov chain, where the Markov chain is obtained by taking your initial Hamiltonian and applying some formula to it. And, you know, the conditions under which that this is true is, you know, it's kind of all the conditions we have here, like the eigenstates of your Hamiltonians have to have all positive amplitudes, and your Hamiltonian has to be something like, you know, if you take it to some finite power, all the entries in the Hamiltonians are positive real numbers as well, too. There's some sort of technical condition here that I'm sweeping under the rug, but just suffice it to say that they're met for this particular case. So it turns out that the problem of analyzing the gap here is the same as the problem of analyzing the gap for a particular Markov chain. And the Markov chain that we need to analyze is this one. It's just a random walk on a one-dimensional line where you have 50% probability of staying, 25% probability of going left, and 25% probability of going right. All right? And now it turns out that this Markov chain is well studied. Like, people know everything about this. And we know that the gap of this is 1 over the length of the chain squared. So the length of our chain is in T, so that means the gap of this Hamiltonian is 1 over T squared for H final. Yeah.
So the Markov chain is just like a conditional probability?
Yeah, sure. So let me explain what a Markov chain is. So a Markov chain is, you imagine that you have some vector B, which is a probability distribution over, you know, the states, say, 1 up to capital N. Okay? And what you imagine is that every point in time, you apply a stochastic process to this distribution, where all you do is, based on your current state, you apply some transition probabilities to going somewhere else. All right? So that's specified by some stochastic matrix M, which tells you that, you know, if you're in state I, you know, Pij, you know, the ijth entry of this matrix is just the probability that if you were in state I, that you didn't transition to state J. All right, so Pij, it's the probability that you go to J, conditioned on starting in I, like at the previous time step. So what happens when you have a Markov chain is that, you know, you apply this matrix M. Let's say you start with some state V, which is, you know, let's say your state V is just you start out in the first state. Like, this is correspondingly saying that you start out in the leftmost block here. Then, yeah.
So I'm just getting confused. Why it's a Markov chain? Because the Hamiltonian, the operator is unitary.
That's right. So this is exploiting the fact that under certain conditions, you can actually map the gap of a Hamiltonian to the gap of a Markov chain. So this is not a generic statement for all Hamiltonians. You can do it, because, you know, your Hamiltonian, you could have, like, complex numbers. I mean, even here, it has some negative numbers. You know, there's no such thing as a negative probability, right? So the statement is that under certain conditions, there exists a stochastic matrix M, which is some function of your Hamiltonian, under which this translation from a Hamiltonian to a Markov chain preserves the gap of the polynomial factors. Yeah, so I agree. This is not an obvious statement. Yeah.
And the gap is independent of U?
The gap, yeah. Yeah, they just prove a lower bound for the gap. It has to be at least this big. Yeah, and the gap could be much bigger depending on your specific circuit. All right. So anyway, so in a Markov chain, you start out with some distribution called V, and you apply the stochastic matrix a bunch of times. And you want to ask what happens to what happens to this probability distribution? Well, it turns out that any stochastic matrix has a so first of all, they all have real eigenvalues. And second of all, they always have an eigenvalue of eigenvalue 1. So that distribution is called pi. That's called the stationary distribution of the Markov chain. So what happens as you apply this this matrix over and over again to V is that it approaches the is that your probability distribution approaches the stationary distribution. And the reason is that if you write out this vector V in its eigenbasis, then so let's just say V is sum of alpha I times lambda I. Now, if you apply this matrix M, T times, what you've done is you've multiplied each of these by lambda I to the T. So if your lambda I is 1, that does nothing. But if your lambda I is even slightly less than 1, then that thing exponentially approaches 0. So all your other components get zeroed out. You're left with the stationary distribution. And the gap between the largest eigenvalue, which is 1, and the second largest eigenvalue, that's called the spectral gap of the Markov chain. And that, you can pretty easily see that that's what controls how quickly you approach the stationary distribution is the gap. It's exactly the same as in this adiabatic theorem, that the gap controls your convergence. So these tools are super useful in theoretical computer science. So there are a ton of different mathematical tools that we have in order to prove bounds on the gaps of stochastic matrices. So by mapping it from a Hamiltonian to a Markov chain, we've really put it more in firmly in computer science territory, where we have a bunch of tools that we can work with. And it turns out that the technical tool that you use to prove this eigenvalue gap is something known as a conductance bound. So what is a conductance bound? See, I'm only going to do one line on this, because I'm just trying to give you guys an intuition. So actually, I'm going to switch these. So the conductance bound is basically a mixture of how well Markov chains mix. You can think of it as a measure of how much churn there is in the stationary distribution. So let's say you have a Markov chain M, and you have some stationary distribution pi. All right, then the conductance of this Markov chain is equal to the following quantity. It's equal to the minimum over subsets S of your states of the amount of probability mass leaving your state S under under the action of M on pi divided by the size of your state. So what you can think of this as is this is measuring how much churn there is in the stationary distribution. It's saying that if you're in the stationary distribution, then although this is stationary under M, what's really happening under the hood is that you have a lot of probability of being in the set leaving it, and you have a lot of the same amount of probabilities coming back from outside the set to come back into the set. So if this quantity called the conductance is high, this is actually, you can relate this to the spectral gap of the stochastic matrix N that you're dealing with. And then this then in turn allows you to lower bound the spectral gap of your Hamiltonian. So this is the basic outline of how this proof works is using a conductance bound like this. I should say that the bound, in order to prove this, you actually need to prove the bound for things slightly more general than this Markov chain, where you have 50% probability of staying 25% left and 25% right. That's the Markov chain that you get when you have H final only. There are a bunch of intermediate Markov chains you get, when you have intermediate values of S. So you have some probability of like you have a higher probability of staying fixed, I think it kicks you out of the zero state to somewhere else. So you actually need to analyze this conductance bound in the whole family of Markov chains, but This is where the magic happens, and this is the core of the technical proof that the gap is inverse polynomial. So putting it all together, what you get is that the gap of your Hamiltonian goes like 1 over t squared. So what that gives you is your total simulation time goes, I think it goes something like t to the fifth. So it's not a super fast simulation. You know, you started out with something that only took you time t, and now you take t to the fifth. But you know, at least you've shown that they're equivalent enough to polynomial factors, which shows that you can use these things to factor or do essentially any other problem you like, as long as that you can solve with a quantum computer, as long as you can tolerate some polynomial loss. So, yeah, I think with that I'll wrap up. Are there any questions?
What happens if you have to go back to the original three-sat problem and then try to...
Yeah. So if you use a three-sat problem and you try to apply this sort of thing, what you end up finding is that for some hard instances that the gap gets very tiny. And basically, it seems like the gap tends to get exponentially small for specifically constructed hard instances. Now, sometimes people still do research on things like, oh, for natural instances, is the gap, more reasonable, or can we turn this into a kind of quantum heuristic algorithm for solving three-sat? And that's something that a lot of people do. But in terms of rigorously proving, that you can solve NPR problems in all cases, so far that vast majority of the evidence is saying that the gap gets exponentially tiny, and then that means that this approach doesn't work. So, yeah. Sure.
If that wasn't the case, then BQP would contain NPR?
That's right, yeah. So if that were not the case, then BQP would contain NP, which would also be a surprising statement in and of itself. So.
Cool. Yep. Why was it important to have the FOC registered in unary?
Oh, that's right. So I never explained why I put the clock in unary. So the thing is that if you write the clock in binary, kind of as I've done it now, these Hamiltonians aren't local. Like, this thing has to touch all of the clock qubits. But if you write it in unary, the nice thing is that where did I put my chalk? The nice thing is that to distinguish time t from time t plus 1, time t is just the thing that looks like 100. If you just look at the bit before and after time t, t is like 100, and time t plus 1 is like 110, right, on those three local things. Like, once you know that the clock is in the valid state, then you only have to look at the qubits like adjacent to the time of interest to tell, in order for you to tell the time. So this then turns this Hamiltonian into a five local Hamiltonian, because then these things are three local, and these unitaries, which are on the state register, are two local, because they're two qubit unitaries. So yeah, it's a good question. Thanks, I forgot to cover that. So. Cool. Yep.
Is the way of using the adiabatic computing?
So D-Wave is doing something similar to adiabatic computing, but it's kind of a different sort of approach, because they know they don't necessarily stay in the ground state the entire time, because they have a bunch of thermal fluctuations and things like this that they know take them out of the ground state. So it's kind of like they have something like an adiabatic quantum computer, but with a lot of like thermal noise or something like this. And it's unclear what the behavior of systems like that looks like. Also, another thing is that they actually, at least at the moment, are using a special type of Hamiltonian called a stochastic Hamiltonian for their time evolution, which is not as general as the types of Hamiltonians that we've been using to prove universality of the adiabatic model. So it's an open question how powerful adiabatic evolution or some sort of noisy adiabatic evolution is with stochastic Hamiltonians. This is an open problem that I think is a really interesting one. All right. Thank you very much.